The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That's the basic framework that NIST has adopted for cybersecurity, software security, and AI. They've said, you shall plan out, right? What are the risks? You shall then measure or detect when the risks occur, and then you shall remedy or mitigate the harm that arises once these events happen. And it's a dramatic shift, right? It's a pivot from where from the types of standards that NIST was pushing out in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where they were really trying to standardize and unify the way that software developers did their jobs. Now it feels like it's a pluralistic, do whatever you want to do, and we're going to try to come up with vocabulary that unifies what you're doing, but it's not actually trying to tell you to do the same thing.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota and Senior Editor at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for March 7th, 2024. Everyone agrees that the United States has a serious cybersecurity problem, but how to fix it, that's another question entirely. Over the past decade, a consensus has emerged across multiple administrations that NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, is the right body to set cybersecurity standards for both the government and private industry. My guest today argues that this faith is misplaced. Brian Choi is an associate professor of both law and computer science and engineering at The Ohio State University. He just published a new white paper in Lawfare's ongoing Digital Social Contract paper series, exploring NIST's history in setting information technology standards and why that history should make us skeptical that NIST can fulfill the cybersecurity demands that are increasingly being placed on it. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 7th. Brian Choi on NIST's software unstandards.
So, Brian, I want to start actually with a biographical question. You studied computer science in college, and you have a joint appointment in the CS department at Ohio State. So you bring a lot of technical knowledge to your legal scholarship. It's honestly something that I, who also writes in this field, am really envious about. And I want to ask, what do you think your technical expertise contributes to how you do your legal scholarship when it comes to sort of law and tech, and in particular the regulation of software, which has kind of become one of the things you're best known for? And also I want to ask more generally, do you think that there's enough technical knowledge in legal academia generally to equip law professors and other scholars to deal with all the tech regulation issues that are here now and will only increase going forward? Or to put another way, if you were giving me advice, right, as someone who doesn't have a CS background, but, you know, spent a bunch of time on Code Academy because he thinks it's fun, you know, is this enough for me to spend the next 20 years of my life writing about AI regulation, let's say?
Yeah, those are two great questions. And let me take them in turn. And the first question, I mean, we often talk in law school about that we train our students to think like a lawyer, right? That's like sort of canonical advice. And I think it's no different with computer science, right? We, you know, you learn to think like an engineer, or you learn how to think like a programmer. When I went and you know, started doing computer science and programming, I felt like I was learning a new language. And then when I went to law school, I felt like I was learning a whole nother language. And so there is a benefit to really doing that formal training because it then gets you in the mindset of, well, how do I build these systems? You know, it doesn't feel like magic. It's more, the steps in which you have to think through the problem and break it down into modules, for instance, and then what can go wrong, right? How do these systems fail? I just, you know, you bring that kind of mindset and experience. So I think there is a lot of value to having that kind of training. Now, could you, you asked a question of, you know, could a casual person, you know, taking some Code Academy or other sort of programming classes also have that mindset? I think sure, right? I mean, depends on how much experience you have. You know, of course, your mileage may vary, but certainly I think any amount of experience or exposure with that kind of problem solving aspect, I think is helpful. Just as, you know, there are people who haven't gone to law school, but have been around lawyers or have been thinking about policy questions. And to a certain extent, of course, they can also think through these problems in a useful, constructive way too. The second question you had, are there enough people? Of course, the answer is never, right? And you can always have more.
Hiring deans, take note. You can always hire more of us, right? More people who are into this.
That's right. Yeah. And increasingly, right, and James Grillman, I think, does a great job of doing this, but you know, software is everywhere, right? It used to be this, you know, it's this niche field. Maybe it's just internet law. Maybe it's, is it even a class at all? But now increasingly, it seems like it touches on every aspect of our daily lives. And so, you know, does having some technical knowledge help us with, you know, administrative law? Does it help us with environmental? You know, all sorts of problems are affected by software. And so when I talk to my engineering sort of undergraduates and they ask, you know, what can I do with a, you know, a technical degree? And sort of like, you know, if I go to law school, and it's like anything, right? You don't have to just be a patent lawyer. You could really do any type of law you want because that kind of training, I feel, is just so, so valuable these days.
Okay, so let's get into the paper. And before we talk about NIST and what it can and cannot provide, let's talk about the problem first, right? At a high altitude, how are we doing? We can define that as the software industry or the government or society generally. How are we doing when it comes to cybersecurity? And is the problem getting worse or better? And how could we tell?
So the problem of cybersecurity seems to be getting worse in some ways and being managed in other ways, right? There was just a news story about a ransomware gang being taken down. We've had those kinds of stories periodically. And of course, another gang comes along and takes its place. So it feels a little bit like whack-a-mole. But, you know, in 2001, Congress passed FISMA to try to help manage this problem of information security. And there were lots of questions of, you know, how do we get agencies to comply and purchase better software.
And just to jump in, for our listeners who may not be familiar, what is FISMA?
FISMA is the Federal Information Security Management Act, I believe is the acronym. And it was an effort to improve information security management in the federal government. Now, that's been expanded. So in 2013, more than a decade later, President Obama said, cybersecurity's gotten only worse, right? So even after having all this kind of paperwork, compliance, trying to get the federal government in compliance with better security practices, you know, the cybersecurity problem was only getting worse. And Melanie Toplinsky has some great writing on that topic. So then we have a bunch of attacks. We have a bunch of problems. President Obama says, well, let's try to figure this out through Congress. Congress stalls, doesn't pass any legislation. And so President Obama then does it by executive order. He calls on NIST to create a cybersecurity framework, and NIST goes ahead and does, you know, complies, creates a cybersecurity framework, and we're still, you know, sort of circling the drain, right? We're still, the problems are not going away. If anything, they seem to be ever present. And so are we, you know, where are we in the big picture? It seems like there's a lot of energy, a lot of effort, a lot of information sharing and coordination, and law enforcement actions. But the size of the problem is so huge, right? It just keeps kind of metastasizing and new problems continue to arise and the old problems don't fully go away. So I would say that, you know, I think this is a fruitful area to research in because it doesn't seem like this is going to be solved anytime
soon.
It's
certainly a full employment program for people like you and me who teach cybersecurity law. But I want to stay on this for a second and dig deeper into why this is such a hard problem. So, you know, I always think about it like, look, when I buy a toaster, I'm pretty confident it doesn't blow up. Like when I am on an airplane, I can be pretty confident, you know, it's not going to fall out of the sky. Now, it turns out a bulkhead may fall off. That's like a recent problem. But like generally, you know, we've gotten very good at security and safety for just the vast majority of devices and practices. And yet there just seems to be something about cybersecurity and more generally software breaking, like in all ways, that, you know, seems to defy our ability to get our arms around it. And it's not like it's a new problem, right? This isn't a technology that's 5 years old. I mean, we've had these problems since the 50s and 60s. I know you've done a lot of great work in other articles kind of touching on this. So I'd love to get your thoughts generally on what is it that seems to make securing software not just a hard problem, but a super hard problem.
Sure. Yeah, this is going back to older work, not the current paper. But software is a double-edged sword, right? It's that if you wanted to limit the plasticity and the capacity or the capability of software, you could do that and you could build pretty robust programs and you could check them and do all the verification that you wanted, but they would be very limited programs, right? And the double-edged sword is that we like software because it enables so much complexity, enables so much functionality because of the abstractness of it, right? It's a construct that is abstracted away from physical constraints. You can kind of world build, right? That's the fantasy, is that you can really build whatever you want in software and code. And because of that, that's just freedom. Then it opens up a level of complexity that is not typical in physically manufactured goods or products. That's why a toaster, right, it's a limited object. It only does a very narrow set of things. Jonathan Zittrain has a wonderful book on that, right? The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. He talks about generativity, and toasters are his leading example of something that is a single-use item, does one thing very well. And if that's the case, then you can product test it and you can fix all the problems with it, and then, you know, you don't expect it to blow up. But software is a different order of magnitude of complexity. And so you can't actually troubleshoot it or test it to in a comprehensive way that gets you that kind of assurance. And so that's the principal problem. And what software industry has done as a result of that problem has been to cut corners, right? So you have to cut corners if you can't actually do comprehensive testing. And so the question is, well, how do you cut corners? And it turns out they just kind of gave up and they said, we're not going to go about this in a very systematic way. We're going to just ship product and we're going to fix problems on the back end in an iterative manner. And so that's why we have all these software updates on a regular basis, right? That's what's happening, as you're saying. Because we can't get this perfect, we're just going to ad hoc it. And then we're just going to kind of put out fires as they come up, right? And because there's no systematic way of doing that, these problems continue to arise. And then when you fix it in that iterative way, new problems will, you might fix some old problems, but you might introduce new problems as well.
So would it be fair to say that the issue is that sort of as software grows in complexity because the processing power increases, therefore allowing us to do things, the sophistication of our languages and tool sets increase, the demands, right? Yeah, as I think Mark Andreessen said, software is eating the world, so we want software to do more stuff. So as software is increasing in complexity, the rate of increase in, let's say, those corner cases that you want to test just has outstripped whatever advances we have in testing. I mean, presumably, tell me if I'm wrong. I hope I'm not wrong. But in 2024, the ability to test software, I hope, is better than it was in 1970. It's just not better enough relative to how much more complex and how much more mission critical the software in 2024 is to what it was in 1970.
Yeah, and it's actually a computational problem, right? There's not enough time or processing power to really test every corner case, every branch of the computer program or the software system. And so you have to come up with some heuristic to do some subset of that, right? Now, there's an interesting question of whether with machine learning and advanced AI techniques, can that be a step forward? Is that a silver bullet, right, that will solve the testing problem in a different way than we've tried to do before? And you know, maybe the jury's out on that. There's been some at least preliminary work suggesting that it's good at detecting faults and errors, but at least in the sort of traditional sense, it's not, you're never going to get comprehensive testing. So the question is, can you make do with some heuristic or some other shortcut to get a good enough coverage of the types of errors that might commonly arise when you're running the system.
It would be quite pleasingly ironic if the way to figure out how these very complicated software systems are working is to take an even more complicated, even less scrutable system and bolt it on top, but we shall see. So you talked about the heuristics, right, that we have to use in lieu of being able to sort of rigorously test. So let's talk about who's going to create those heuristics, who's going to recommend that. I think that gets us to the heart of the paper, which is your really interesting analysis of what NIST can and perhaps more importantly cannot do in this space. So let's talk about NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which is a kind of sub-agency under the Department of Commerce. So just kind of briefly, what is NIST? What is its history? And why is everyone talking about it recently?
Yeah, so let me start by actually telling you how I got to this project, sort of the motivation of it. And so I live in Ohio. I would say about 2017, 2018, there started to be talk about this Data CARES Act. Which is ultimately enacted in 2019. And so I was starting here. People started to say, is this a good thing, right? So what Ohio wanted to do was it wanted to protect small businesses from liability for data breach litigation. And they said, if you comply with one of these recognized cybersecurity frameworks, the NIST cybersecurity framework being sort of one of the more prominent examples of these, if you comply with one of these cybersecurity frameworks, then you'll be absolved of liability. It's a safe harbor. You don't have to worry about it. And it was seen as an incentive to comply with one of these cybersecurity frameworks. And before that, I hadn't really been paying attention to NIST. And I sort of said, well, how would this work? Like, what would you actually do differently in order to get this safe harbor? I was very skeptical of it. And someone would say, but don't you trust NIST? I mean, NIST is great. Don't you think this could work? Or what do you think about this? Right. And I said, I don't know what I think about this. So I started to look into it. So then, I approached the problem with a bit of skepticism. I said, what could NIST do? I haven't really heard NIST doing anything, internet-wise for a while. And so as I started to dig into it, I realized actually NIST has done a lot, right? So the National Institute of Standards and Technologies got its start in the early 20th century, 1901, originally was named the National Bureau of Standards, and it was a very respected organization. They came out with all kinds of weights and measures and metrics and a whole bunch of basic science research. This was sort of federal government at its best.
So these were like literally the people that were like, this is what an inch is, right? And exactly how many centimeters or whatever.
Or these were the people who said, that is... you may think you know what an inch is, but we're going to standardize it, and you're not going to have each state determine what an inch is or what measures people can use. And if you go back to the 19th and 18th century, right, people did, in fact, each state was had its own conception of which measures were ideal. But in order to promote international competitiveness, the federal government said we want to have standard measures. Right, this helps with both buying products and selling products internationally. And so that's why NIST is situated in the Department of Commerce, because this was seen as a way of promoting international commerce. Okay, so NIST, very well respected, helps with the war efforts and so forth, gets into basic science. And anytime there's a sort of a big problem, scientific or technological problem, the federal government would look to NIST to kind of lead those efforts. And computing technologies, when it became started to become prominent in the 1940s, again, NIST took the lead there, right? So they helped build some of the first computers. They helped the federal government navigate computing technology. They were sort of IT support for the federal government, and that was one of their major roles. And anytime there was a project like the census or any kind of big computing problem, they would sort of help consult on those kinds of problems as well. That's in 1965, NIST was tasked with coming up with federal information processing standards. And this was, a budget issue. The federal government decided that they were wasting too much money on redundant code and computer management. So why not consolidate that under NIST, have them come up with standards that would make the federal government operate more efficiently? That was the sort of the main premise of the mission.
Yeah, so it's great because you've gotten us sort of up to the 60s, And you write in your paper about how NIST played an important role in cybersecurity standards, you know, in the 60s and in the 1970s, but that its influence has waned quite dramatically since then. So what happened? Why was this sort of 60s, 70s NIST's high watermark in this space?
So, when it first got started, there was a lot of faith in government. I would say this was the high watermark of federal agency standard setting, right? You think about the highway safety, traffic safety, environmental safety, all these major legislative actions were happening in the 1960s. And so the federal government dutifully went off and started creating a bunch of standards. And NIST was no different. The problem, I would say, is that it just took so long and it was so expensive. So NIST estimated it was spending about 80% of its budget coming up with these standards and developing them and getting it through the sort of rulemaking process. And there's just so many problems it needed to tackle. And if it's taking 3 to 5 years per standard to get this across the finish line, meanwhile, the software industry in the 1980s, right, was taking off, right? This was like the microcomputers, Apple and Microsoft were competing, just a whole bunch of innovation was happening in the computing space. And for NIST to try to keep up with that it was just too ponderous. I mean, you think about all the stereotypes of big government being too slow and too inefficient. And in some ways that was true. NIST was very careful, very diligent about its task. But, in some ways that strength was also a weakness. So in the 1980s, right, they continue to push out standards. They were actually very productive in the early to mid 1980s. But by 1987, there was a sense that this was not the way, right? The Department of Defense was starting to say, we can't manage all these standards. We need to privatize them. We really should be. There's a sort of a famous report written by a committee led by Fred Brooks that said we really should be pivoting away from from writing our own code unless it's strictly necessary. We should be buying off-the-shelf commercial software, which is both cheaper, better, more effective, does all the things that it's supposed to do. And to the extent that there isn't off-the-shelf software, we can write custom software, but that should be the exception, not the rule. That took from about 1987 to about 1995 before it became federal policy. So, it still limped along for a little while, but it was in those moments where the federal government was starting to pivot away from being the leader in computing standards. The rest of the 90s, right? NIST is not engaged in standard setting. It's actually withdrawing from those activities. And so you think about the early 90s, the early internet era, right? Netscape and all that. NIST is not, NIST is in the background, right? They're still participating in standard setting bodies, but they were not taking the leadership role the way they had been in the early decades.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing,
Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
Now, as you write, more recently, NIST has been engaged in setting some computer standards, primarily in cybersecurity, software development, and AI. How has that gone? And what differences have there been, to the extent there have been, between how NIST has done its job more recently to how it, you know, would have done its job in the kind of 70s and early 80s?
There's a sense of urgency that's forced NIST's hand, right? The White House, across multiple administrations, Obama, Trump, Biden, have all suddenly decided that NIST is this expert agency that can sort of wave a magic wand and come up with standards that will solve problems in cybersecurity and AI and software quality. They haven't given quite the budget, I think, that NIST would need, and the timelines have been extraordinarily short. It's like within a year, you will come up with standards that solve all of AI, for instance, right? Like, we'll make it trustworthy, we'll make it reliable, safe, fair, transparent, all these things, and you're going to do it within, right, 12 to however many months. And it just seems so unrealistic. Now, NIST has, you know, they can't complain, they can't say no, so they have to do something. And what they've done is they've just adapted the FISMA standard the FISMA framework that I mentioned before. So FISMA was this risk-based management or risk management framework. It sort of says, you know, evaluate and assess the risks that you might have to your information management systems. And then once you have a sense of the risk landscape, you'll come up with a plan to manage those risks. And then you will act accordingly if any of those risks come to bear. That's the basic framework that NIST has adopted for cybersecurity, software security, and AI. They've said, you shall sort of plan out, right? What are the risks? You shall then measure or detect when the risks occur, and then you shall remedy or mitigate the harm that arises once these events happen. And it's a dramatic shift, right? It's a pivot from where from the types of standards that NIST was pushing out in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where they were really trying to standardize and unify the way that software developers did their jobs. Now it feels like it's a pluralistic, do whatever you want to do, and we're going to try to come up with vocabulary that unifies what you're doing, but it's not actually trying to tell you to do the same thing. So it's almost the exact opposite of what we would think a standard does.
Yeah, I have to say, this all sounds quite underwhelming. And I suspect you agree, because your title of the paper is NIST's Software Unstandards. I mean, these aren't actually standards, right?
They're not standards. NIST, in fact, disclaims that they're standards. They say, it doesn't make sense to say, I am complying with these frameworks, because compliance means very different things to different parties. It's a kind of what I call a choose your own adventure kind of framework. You get to choose which elements that you want to include in your plan. And then for each of the elements that you do include in your plan, you get to set sort of the timing or the terms of what it means to do well on that particular term. So I'll give you an example. When you discover a vulnerability in your software, right, you should probably remedy that, right? You should patch the vulnerability. Now, the question that comes up is, how quickly should you patch your vulnerability? Because it may be a very critical vulnerability. It may not be a critical vulnerability at all. But there's a lot of uncertainty as to how much time you should take between the detection of the vulnerability and the patching of the vulnerability. Now, you would think NIST cybersecurity framework would give you an answer, right? Should it be 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, a year, 5 years? A decade, how long should you have before that known vulnerability gets patched? And the answer is that NIST does not provide any answer. It says the organization shall determine for itself what the appropriate timing is, and the organization shall determine all other kinds of aspects of this policy of how quickly you want to patch these vulnerabilities. In fact, the cybersecurity framework doesn't necessarily say you have to have this rule or policy in your plan at all. Presumably, it would be wise to do so. But if you didn't, NIST wouldn't say, they wouldn't bring the hammer down. They wouldn't say, oh, you're non-compliant with our framework. There is no such thing, right? So that's why I call it a choose your own adventure, because you can really come up with whatever plan you want, and there is no such thing as non-compliance.
Well, so going back earlier in our conversation, when you talked about how you got interested in NIST, I mean, going back to this example of this Ohio law that provided safe harbor, if I'm understanding this correctly, this safe harbor wouldn't really mean that much, because what exactly is how can you even tell if the company is complying with the safe harbor, right? It's either so vague that you can't tell, or it's so meaningless that it's just a box checking exercise that doesn't actually accomplish the goal. I mean, are you as disappointed with all of this as I am? Or is there some wisdom to this approach?
So there's some disappointment, and perhaps there's some wisdom, right? What it does accomplish is it says, if you must have a plan, you must have some documentation. And I think that is one of NIST's goals, right? There are organizations that are doing less than the minimum. They don't even have a plan. And so how do you measure compliance with the framework is that you have created some paperwork that is nominally nodding towards a cybersecurity framework. Now, the disappointing part of it is, as you were suggesting, is the substance there could be almost anything. And all you have to do is write at the top, cybersecurity framework or cybersecurity plan. And then presumably you're in compliance or in, doing something that looks like what NIST wants. Now, of course, if you're a good faith actor, that might be actually pretty good, right? If you genuinely want your organization to be good at deterring cyber attacks, I think there is some reason to hope that the organization will be better after evaluating its risks and then, taking some actions to fix the things that aren't good, right? But as lawyers, we're always trained to think about this from the shoes of a bad actor, the bad man, or that's the Oliver Wendell Holmes framework. And so if all you care about is avoiding liability, then you're going to do the bare minimum. You're not going to actually improve your organization's security practices, and then you won't bear any of the liability costs either. Now, my scholarship work has tried to impose more of those costs on these software organizations, because I think that tort liability and in general costs, legal costs, are a great incentive to improve behavior. Right? Now, it's not necessarily the most efficient, or you know, certainly there are alternatives, but I think it's a key component of the overall ecosystem. And so if you're allowing these organizations to escape the liability framework entirely by doing nothing, or de minimis, then I think that cheats the legal system out of a key lever that it has. And so that's why I think it's quite disappointing in those respects.
So let's now talk about the lessons that you draw from this kind of historical analysis of NIST, in particular for attempts by the government to use NIST to improve cybersecurity standards. And I want to divide it into sort of two parts. One is, what should we do about NIST, or how should we use NIST? And the second is, what should we do generally, right? Because maybe if not NIST, then maybe someone else. So let's talk about NIST first. Do you have any confidence that reliance on NIST will actually advance the ball? Or will NIST just do what it's been doing? Again, maybe for no fault of its own, because it's given a hard job, which is, look, you want standards? We'll give you standards. But it's a little bit like there's a great joke that the comedian Stephen Colbert once made about due process. It's no big deal. Due process is just the process that we do. It's a little bit like that, right? A NIST standard is just a standard that comes from NIST, even if it's actually an unstandard that doesn't say anything. Or do you think, again, to your point about good actors, your good faith actors, NIST can meaningfully advance the ball here?
I think we have to think about the types of problems that NIST can do meaningful work on. I've identified, so crypto seems to be one of those areas where NIST is really good.
Crypto as in encryption, not cryptocurrencies.
That's correct, right? Although maybe it extends to cryptocurrencies. But encryption, cryptographic technologies seems to be an area where NIST has had impact, and the cryptographic community seems to accept NIST as a reputable go-between or convener. And so why is that the case, right? And I have a hypothesis that crypto may be just, one, it's more mathematical, it's more limited in scope, right? You have one job to do. All you have to do is translate text to numbers, into encrypted or some kind of encryption, right? You're doing a translation. That's all you're doing, and to do it well. And then also, because it's highly mathematical, because it's perhaps more technical, it's a smaller community, right? And to be accepted into the crypto community, right, you join this cohort. And so there's a greater chance of consensus among that community about what constitutes good crypto. And so if you can find other areas like that, then perhaps there's more hope for NIST as a convening role, or even as producing standards that provide consensus and uniformity the way that that we would want a standard to do.
And do you think that there are such areas? I mean, are there maybe parts of AI and machine learning that are more sort of technical rather than these very difficult policy trade-offs between values X, Y, and Z?
That's one area where I have a possible optimism, which is perhaps AI and machine learning have similar attributes where it's very mathematical, very technical. It's a very small, closed community of people who are really at the top of the field. I don't mean sort of the people who are installing it on their laptops at home, but I mean the people who are really kind of thinking about the high theory of machine learning and deep neural nets. It's a very small community relative to software development as a whole, right? And so perhaps in that area, you could, NIST might have some comparative advantage to be able to develop consensus standards in a way that resembles crypto. That said, AI is a much broader task, right? It's not like encryption where you're only doing a single narrow task. AI is being sold and marketed as being able to do almost anything you want, and all the problems attendant with that. And so perhaps that's a reason to have some question about it. But I think we should at least see some areas where NIST is able to make some progress. So for instance, NIST has done work, early work, on developing standard data sets for instance, handwritten digits or fingerprints. And that work was very instrumental in getting machine learning off the ground in those areas. Those data sets played an important role. And so could NIST provide some kind of certification or convening role in that sense in curating the certain types of data sets that are more legitimate than, say, these scraped data sets from all of the internet where we have no idea what's inside and whether the quality is good or bad.
Or maybe benchmarks as well. I mean, things of that kind of technical training nature.
So perhaps testing benchmarks is another kind of data. Is that another way that NIST could contribute, right? So you could think of a few areas within AI and machine learning that might play to NIST's strengths. And I'm really interested in exploring that in future work.
Okay, so we've talked about NIST, and I think we've been a little hard on NIST, but again, we've given them an impossible problem, and it's better that NIST do what they can do well than be asked to do an impossible thing. But let's put NIST aside, because I want to kind of conclude this conversation by, again, just zooming out and asking, okay, forget NIST. Joe Biden gives you a call. Brian, I've made you my all things software czar, right? Fix the problems for me, right? Okay, we've talked about NIST. We've learned our lessons. But now, not limiting ourselves to that, right? What else can we do? Right. And should we use NIST as, and this is what you end your paper on, and what I kind of want to push back a little bit, because I thought that was very provocative in your paper. Should we think of NIST as defining the ceiling of what we can do, right? Whether we call it, do it in NIST or call it, the Department of Good Programming, right? Or should we say, look, there's something about NIST that limits it, right? We should make a new thing be more ambitious, give it an infinite budget, right? If what we've learned from machine learning is that you just need more compute. Maybe the same is true for regulation. You just need more bodies, right? What does, software czar Brian Choi do?
Yeah. So the other interesting aspect of focusing on NIST, that question, is because I think NIST is a really good example of an expert agency, right? It's probably the canonical example of an expert agency. There has been this tendency in the literature and it's a recent trend, to say we should appoint some czar, some new agency. We should invent a new agency that will solve all our software or AI problems for us. And in fact, some of the bills that were on the floor, right, in Congress this year include, let's create a national AI commission. I've heard of proposals to create a FDA for algorithms or a robotics commission, or you hear various iterations of this as if creating a new agency will be the silver bullet, will be a magic fix for the problem that has bedeviled us for decades. And I just find that so hard to believe. And I think we should stop talking about a fix in those terms, because I don't think it's productive. We have a whole bunch of existing agencies that have a lot of built-up expertise in their domains, and they have all struggled to work on this problem. Here, the leading example, I think, is the FDA. The FDA has been dealing with medical device software for decades, and they just don't have a great approach to it. Often it's just, one, medical device software is that arm of the FDA is less funded than the drug arm of FDA. And so the review is a little more cursory anyway. And there's a second question of, once software is approved, what happens to it after that? Right? And the FDA says, you should update the software, but we might take a look if we think that we should. Right? It's just such a piecemeal approach to medical device software as is. Now throw AI into the mix and suddenly the FDA is saying, our existing approach doesn't work at all. We have to come up with a completely new review plan. We have to tear apart the rule book and come up with some entirely new thing because AI is so different. And if the FDA is doing that, right, it suggests they don't really have an answer, even though they've been studying this since at least the early 2000s, and even before that, right, in the early 1990s, they started looking at this problem. So what is a new agency going to do differently that NIST or FDA or FTC is often invoked? What is it going to do differently than any of these existing agencies? It's going to inherit a bunch of political problems. There's, it'll be its own domain. Once you create it, it'll never die, right? And then it'll just have overlapping jurisdiction with all of these other pre-existing agencies. What do I think is a better solution? It depends on whether we think that we can get some kind of unanimity or consensus in this area. And again, maybe AI is different, but at least with software, I'm not convinced that we're going to get a definitive answer about what constitutes good software practice. Right? Instead, it's going to continue to be this melange of approaches. Different companies and different developers are going to have their own philosophies about how to develop software and how to test software. And, I think we should take a pluralistic approach. And so I've argued in other work that a professional care standard would work well for that. That's a bit of an idiosyncratic view that I've promoted. But the advantage that I see with that is that it embraces the existing landscape of software development and then overlays a legal oversight on top of that without being too disruptive of the existing practice. So we have some legal oversight, not no legal oversight, the way it has been. And at the same time, we allow software development to continue mostly as it has.
And the idea here is, just to be clear, right, is just as you and I as lawyers are professionals in the technical sense, there is a profession, it is self-regulating, there are certain standards. Those standards vary in their level of specificity according to how appropriate they should be. And that is one of the primaries we deal with it. So we should think of programmers and system designers also as professionals in that sense, and that, we need to have a legal superstructure of liability that encourages them to regulate themselves, and then just hope, right, that they know enough, they're the experts, that they will just, if they're incentivized to spend a bunch of time thinking about it, they will figure it out. Is that, at a very crude level, is that a decent description of what you'd propose?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we want to incentivize software developers to at least avoid the worst mistakes, right? Just as with medicine, right? We don't always know what's the best medical care, right? There's it could be a range of opinions. You ask, different doctors, they might all have a different approach to treating cancer, for instance. The superstructure, right? The legal oversight is to say, well, all of those approaches are acceptable as long as you all agree that it's not below the standard of care. Certainly, no self-respecting doctor would recommend this. And so that component has been missing, I think, in software regulation. Right now we just say, hey, if you can go to some code camp, minimal experience, you put out some code and it fails, and well, nothing happens to you, right? There's no kind of self-policing or no sort of minimum baseline of what we consider to be malpractice, right? Before the legal system gets involved.
And I assume that, so just as with medicine, where it's not an either or, right? We both have professional medical associations that set standards, but we also have an FDA, right, that simply doesn't allow doctors to prescribe certain things until the FDA has signed off on them. We might have a similar situation here where those things that a regulator like NIST can do, which is, figure out what are the quote unquote, good cryptographic primitives, they would do that. But the rest of the stuff, you just have to kind of let the community of practitioners figure it out for themselves.
That's a really interesting suggestion for the role of agencies, right? Because I don't want to cut agencies out of the ecosystem entirely, right? They have a role to play too. And so the question is, well, what is their role? What's their comparative advantage? One of them is that you are the centralized authority that can set rules. And I guess the fear that I have is that they would exercise that rule in a ham-handed way, right? For instance, password policy. NIST comes out with a password policy, and that becomes the policy for everyone. You shall have special characters and capital letters and so on, and without it necessarily being good policy, right? So what's a better use of that kind of centralized authority? It could be, as you suggest, right, that certain software is certified and say that's good enough. We accept it for certain uses, and the medical device software could be an example. There might be other domain-specific software where you need that kind of certification. And if NIST is able, or NIST or some other agency is able to provide that kind of assurance and update it frequently, right, periodically, right, they're not just going to say once and done, then perhaps that could be a useful role that's separate from, say, a standard-setting authority or an enforcement authority, the way that we've thought of the agencies, right? Right now, we think of agencies as in those terms, like the FTC is going to go after you if you have a bad privacy policy, or if you use facial recognition in a bad way or something. You know, there's certain ideas about what the agency should be doing.
Well, I think this is a good place to wrap it up. It's a fascinating topic, a great paper. Thank you so much for writing it and for coming on the show to talk about it.
Thanks very much. And I'm looking forward to continuing to explore these topics. So stay tuned.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osmond of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.